The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian Bea Jermaine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
Absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is This is a hole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is Bea Jermaine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 15 of the Ozboycast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning in the 70s right up until today. And with me, as always, is my very awesome Aussie co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello. Good to be back. And yeah, it's always interesting to discuss the Ozploitation films. And I've noticed, as of this episode, we have now watched over 70 Ozploitation movies.
That is a lot of Ozploitation films, Marcy, and we have still have so many to go. And mind you, we're only just like within the third year of the 80s, so we still have a couple of decades to go before we reach today's films.
Yeah, still quite a couple of decades to go, and I'm very impressed that I can say we've watched over 70 movies. It's like mind-boggling.
Indeed. But before we get into the episode at hand, we have a very special guest joining us, and he's making his return after appearing a few episodes back on the show. But he has been on a few episodes of this show, and that, of course, is our good friend and the co-host of the podcast, Fearless Pretender, and that is Sam Inglis. Hello, Sam, and welcome back to the Ozploycast.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back again. And for the record, this takes me up to 20 Ozploitation movies for this podcast. This is my fourth episode.
You have to catch up on the previous 50 that you haven't seen yet, Sam.
I'm pretty sure Sam can miss a bunch of those ones.
I mean, there are some that I definitely want to see. Others I might skip, including some of these.
Which is fair.
Indeed. But before we get into the episode tonight, which we are going to be talking about the Ozploitation films, Attack Force Z, A Dangerous Summer, Freedom, Next of Kin, and Midnight Spares, we have to start the episode off on a sad note, unfortunately. And that is because at the time of this recording, because the day before on March 14th, 2024, we lost a major player in the Ozploitation movement, when the legendary and very awesome actor and stuntman Grant Page passed away at the age of 85.
Yeah, it was very sad to hear the news or read the news, especially as we've been on this journey. Grant Page has been an influence on so many of the films that we have been watching. But not only that, like, his work is in so many films, ones that you might not even realize he may have worked on. So definitely a legendary name, somebody who kind of put a face to the stunts. And there are so many films that he's just been a part of. And I think one that I'd recommend, Death Cheaters, for ultimate Grant Page.
Obviously, I haven't seen as much of Grant Page as you guys have, but I have definitely noticed through doing this show with you on occasion that he's been a real mainstay of the Ozploitation movement, a real legend of that whole occupation. amazing that you get to 85 doing what he did to his body for movies, it's got to be said. And by all accounts that I've heard, a really good guy as well. So Death Cheaters and I've heard about Stunt Rock as well are both films that I've really been wanting to see. So I think you've covered both of those, haven't you? And I just wasn't on those episodes.
Yes, we have. Yes. But you were on an episode in which he was a star in. That was Road Games, where he played the film's villain, Smith or so-and-so, I believe the character's name was.
Indeed. And we covered Mad Max, of course, which is one of his legendary jobs. So I've definitely got, if not the sort of overview of him, a real appreciation for Grant Page and just for the Australian stunt industry. And we'll cover some of that today from this podcast and working on it with you guys.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I also would mention, like, definitely if you want to see his leading man work as an actor, definitely check out both Stunt Rock and Death Cheaters, which he is just so charismatic in both those films. And
so charismatic. Like, you care more about, like, just the hanging out with the characters kind of thing, especially, I think, Death Cheaters than anything else. And I think that's just thanks to how charismatic he was as well.
Oh, definitely. And also, I would also even mention, like, his big action set piece in The Man from Hong Kong, where he went toe-to-toe with Jimmy Wong Yu in that insane fight scene between the two of them. And that was one of his earliest on-screen roles when he's not doing behind-the-scenes work as a stuntman. But yeah, that scene in particular is pretty insane and just a superb fight sequence. So you can definitely tell, like, just how talented of an actor and, most importantly, a stuntman he was. You would even say he's probably the first big superstar stuntman in all of film.
And by all accounts, Jimmy Wang Yu did not fuck about on set. He wasn't one to pull his punches very much. So Man from Hong Kong is also very much on my list.
Definitely. Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. And a lot of the amazing, like, hang gliding scenes and stuff, that was all Grant Page's work. I think he's listed as, like, stunt coordinator, hang gliding coordinator, and hang gliding person. There's so many things. But yeah, and I think, look, after the stunts on Mad Dog Morgan, I think we can say, like, you got to your mid to late 80s after that. That's kind of incredible.
Oh, yeah. And he was still doing, like, stunt work and stunt coordination work on films right up until a few years ago, which is even more insane given how old he was at the time when he made a lot of these films.
Incredible. Like, there's an immense, like, bunch of work. So I certainly highly recommend people to check it out, and you can always look him up on IMDb and see what stunt coordinator or stunts or performer, like, all that stuff that he did, and I think you'll be very impressed.
I'll definitely.
And let's maybe just use this opportunity to once again say there needs to be a stunt coordination and probably a stunt performance category at the Oscars.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think that 100%. Is one. Yeah, exactly. Especially in the last few years where stunts and films have gotten even more and more impressive, that I think it will definitely happen at some point. The question is when, but I think if anything, it's definitely going to happen at some point. And and honestly, if Grant Page was still here, he would be my pick as the first recipient of that award, but that's beside the point. But anyways, so we'll definitely miss you, Grant Page. You're a legend. We'll still continue watching all of your work in the years to come. And we still have plenty more of films that feature him and also feature more stunt work from him for this show in the future. But yeah, RIP, Grant Page, we'll miss you very much. You're an Ozploitation legend. So we might as well get into the episode tonight and talk about five very different Ozploitation films for this episode. And we'll go into the very first film, which, of course, is the 1982 war film Attack Force Z.
Hidden on a small Pacific island is a man with a secret. The secret men will kill for. A secret that could end the Second World War. And a highly trained attack force is sent to get him back or die trying.
You can handle him all right, can't you?
Oh, no worries. For me, mate, you can handle him with both hands tied behind him.
So begins the war's most terrifying true mission.
Now, we're after a man who was on that plane.
I am looking for American survivors from the aeroplane.
What questions did the Japanese ask?
A handful of men face the might of the Japanese army on a mission that can only succeed with men prepared to die. It's a mission that will affect the lives of hundreds of innocent people. And it will change the lives of some forever.
You know what your father said about the war not changing anything? He's wrong. It changes everything.
I will not tell you that we are your friends, but I will tell you that the war has come to this island, that you must choose a side.
Attack Force C. In the jungle, 1,000 men may die, and a handful can become a legend. Attack Force Z is the story of that legend. Starring John Philip Law, Mel Gibson, Sam Neill, Koo Chuan Seong, and introducing the beautiful Sylvia Chang. Attack Force Z.
This film was directed by a filmmaker who has been featured a lot on this very show, Tim Burstall. It was written by Roger Marshall, and it stars Mel Gibson, John Philip Law, Sam Neill, John Waters, Chris Haywood, Sylvia Chang, Koo Chuan Hsiang, and if I butchered your name, please forgive me, and O.T. And the plot summary from IMDb is... A group of Australian commandos launch a secret mission against Japanese forces in World War II. Now, Marcy, I know this is a first-time watch for you, and I think it is for all of us, for most of the films on this show, but tell us your thoughts on Attack Force Z.
Yeah, I'll start off by saying that I think when you kind of think of an Australian war film, you pretty much think of, like, Gallipoli, which you actually would, you know, back in my day, we watched that in like high school. And I don't think I had actually really thought about there being other kind of war films from Australia. So lo and behold, here is a World War II film. And look, there was definitely some stuff going on during pre-production with this film, as Tim Burstall pretty much took on the role the night before shooting was going to start. Mm-hmm. And I think there was some differences in where they wanted the script and story to go with the original director, who was Philip Noyce, who worked on it for about 6 weeks before being fired, apparently. And it does feel somewhat of an uneven film. And it's very weird to... How do I put this? It's like, it starts off where there's the sort of group of like Aussie commandos. They're on this mission to kind of, as you find out, they got to retrieve somebody who, I guess they said they were defecting or such and such. So it's quite an important mission. But as they're trying to find out what happened and get this rescue mission, they end up like helping a small village against the Japanese forces. So then it kind of becomes like what would come to mind is like the classics of Kurosawa with the ragtag group protecting the village, which would be remade many times. That's kind of the impression I thought this second half was going to take. So it's one thing and then it's another thing. And I was kind of confused at parts as well. Like I was like, where are they? Who are these people? Okay, we're back to these people. but who are these people? It was a little confusing, and it kind of had this very, I guess, bleak. I don't know if I'd call it bleak, but it was an ending that was like, that kind of all felt like a waste of time. And was that kind of the point, that war is just meaningless? It's hard to say. I do think like the cast was quite decent. It's a decent looking film, and there is a lot of gratuitous violence, which certainly puts it in there as an Ozploitation film. But I think it sounded more interesting than it actually turned out to be. It's not to say I didn't think it was worth watching. It's a very uneven film for me.
And Sam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. I think it's a film that sort of is torn in two directions. It's like trying to be a character-driven men-on-a-mission film in the vein of The Dirty Dozen, and give each of the members of the commando group something of an identity. But the script just does not give the actors the tools to do that. The writing just does not differentiate enough between each of the commandos. You really can only pick out Sam Neill and Mel Gibson, not so much as characters, but because they're Sam Neill and Mel Gibson. And for audiences outside of Australia, I think those will be the only people that they'll ever really latch on to, because, as I say, the others just sort of blend into soldiers, in inverted commas. They're just not very interesting humans. And the mission isn't particularly well defined, I think, and nor are the people that they're fighting with and for. There's a few interesting notes in the cast. Well, one really, which is Sylvia Chang, who plays like the woman who helps them translate and gets close to one of the soldiers. She is, a couple of years before, she was in King Hu's Legend of the Mountain, which is one that I've still got to see. And then some years later, 92, I think it is. Yeah, 92. She's Jackie Chan's mother at the beginning of Twin Dragons, when she gives birth to baby Jackie Chan, when the two twins are kidnapped and separated in the hospital. So there's a few fun notes in there. And Chang, she's done other relatively notable things, like Mountains May Depart was a rather well-received art house piece a few years ago. And she's worked right up to 2022, and also directed a bunch of films. So some interesting stuff going on with that. But other than that sort of side note interest, I don't think there's much here. The action's okay. I don't really remember any particular sequences as terribly notable. To be honest, the thing that really amused me most was that there's a cast member named John Waters, and I could only think when I saw that name in the credits, oh God, I wish it was the other John Waters, and I still do.
And yeah, it's funny that he was like quite high build, but he's out of the movie in the first like 15 or something minutes.
Well, I think that's kind of a funny thing too, because reading up about the film is that his character was actually a late addition into the script, because it says here, like on Wikipedia, filming was further delayed by, okay, among the changes made were adding a fifth character to the team, a soldier played by John Waters, who would be killed within the first 10 minutes of the film by one of their own men.
That God sequence Waters is probably the best sequence in the film, by the way. It's the only one that really presents the moral dilemma compellingly.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because I'm fully aware of John Waters, I mean, Australian actor John Waters, because he was like on the TV show Play School back in the day, and also started quite a number of films and TV shows. So I'm very much familiar of his work. But I think what's interesting, though, is like, I thought, okay, he's fifth billed. He's one of the big major cast members. He's probably going to be around for a while. And the fact that he gets killed off within the first 10 minutes, and not only by that, he gets a mercy killing from Sam Neill. I was actually taken aback because I was like, okay, I was not expecting that type of scene in a film this early. But I think for my personal thoughts on Attack Force Z, I can definitely see the flaws that you have both suggested. It is a very uneven film, and I think having the constant kind of rechanging of the script and also bringing in Tim Burstall at the very last minute to take over directing from Philip Noyce. And this is like the second time this has happened on the show, because remember, Philip Noyce was also meant to direct Hoodwink, which we talked about a few episodes back as well, but then he left that project. So, but I got to say, I still very much enjoyed the film overall. I mean, I'm a sucker for Met on a Mission films, so they're always going to be my bread and butter whenever I sit down to watch them. And I got to say, I really enjoyed this one. It's definitely not the most original in terms of plots for these type of films, but I just found that it's still a pretty entertaining film. And I think the actors, like, even though most of them don't really have much in terms of development, I think the actors themselves do at least bring something to the roles that made them compelling, at least for me. But I would even say, like, the character within the village, this, like, Sylvia Chang and a few others, like, I think those actors were actually quite good in their performances, and them having to team up with these soldiers to fight the Japanese army. And like you say, Marcy, when the actual big battle sequence happens in the last half, it is very bloody, it is very violent. And so definitely that exploitation vibe comes in there. But
it kind of almost feels like the end of Commando. It's kind of like that over the top.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just
bodies everywhere.
Oh, definitely. Like, literally stacks of bodies on top of each other.
Literally.
Although I got to say, Marcy, did a part of you just kind of giggle a little bit when you found out that Mel Gibson's character's name is Paul Kelly?
Now I am.
Yeah. Well, for those for context,
that didn't even occur to me in the film. So, wow.
For a bit of context, in Australia, we have a famous singer, songwriter, musician named Paul Kelly, who's a legend in his own right. So I just found it funny that there was a character in this movie that has the same name as him before, like, he became big himself. But I also got to say, Marcy, because you mentioned, like, how the ending of the film, where they basically have to go in and rescue this person, and then...
Well, they're trying to get the person safely out from the village, but also defend the village from... the Japanese soldiers. Yeah. Like, a lot going on here.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely a lot going on. But the fact that basically, other than Mel Gibson's character, everyone in his team is killed off. And then the person they went to go rescue, like, Mel Gibson gets him into the boat at the end. He thinks, oh, we're out of here, we're safe. And he finds out that the guy was shot during the battle. I can definitely see your point. Like, it just feels like it was all for nothing. And in a way, I feel like that is the point, especially with war. And I thought that was such a kind of a daring thing for the film to do. Basically, like, in the end, this team kind of lost. Like,
yeah, but at the same time, like, Sylvia Chang's character was pretty much the only one left in the village alive.
Yeah, yeah, that's also the other thing I got to give the film respect for is, like, in a way, they kind of all lost. Yeah, they fought the
Everybody
Japanese.
Literally lost. Like,
yeah.
And that's what I'm wondering. Like, was it just they didn't know how to end this movie or what they were doing? Or is it purposely, like, a war is kind of pointless?
I think that's probably
really a winner kind of thing.
I think that bleakness is deliberate. I think it doesn't pull it off as particularly tragic because we don't know who any of the people are. In a better movie, I think, in a better written movie in particular, I think that would have played really well. Like, war, the futility of war, and the idea that even when you win, you don't really win, is an idea that is not particularly unique in war movies, but I think it definitely structurally has that going from the beginning with the John Waters character to the ending, but it just doesn't color its characters in enough for it to really matter to us.
I don't know. I feel like it did for me. At least, maybe it's because, again, outside of Mel Gibson and Sam Neill, I already knew who the other actors were. So I was invested with these characters, the soldiers, but also the people within this small village and how they're affected by the Japanese army because they're in constant fear of them. So I guess for me, it kind of worked, but I could definitely at the same time see your point too, Sam. But it's interesting because I'm like looking because out of the cast members who I was not really that familiar with, and that was John Philip Law, who's an American actor who they cast into.
Same film here. I'm like, I actually don't know this name. And for being kind of the import actor, I don't think he outshone anybody particularly, but maybe it was just that charisma that he had with his character that I felt like there was more of a connection with him in a way. But as Sam said, you don't really get to know who these characters are. And I do think some of this character stuff from the script was probably scrapped for some more like action scenes and stuff, because you do feel like there's little bits missing here and there.
Oh yeah, I can definitely see that too. And I guess like looking up John Philip Law's filmography, I sort of noticed he has been in a bunch of movies. Most of us probably have seen. He was in Barbarella. He was in that. He was also in the last movie. Oh, probably one of his best known roles is a spaghetti western called Death Rides a Horse. And he also played Diabolik in Danger of Diabolik.
I just didn't quite recognize the
person. Well, I think that's kind of blink. Like, it is. Yeah, I mean, like, now though, it's like, okay, I've seen him in stuff, but I don't sort of remember him in those
films. Familiarity of the face, I think.
Yeah, I think it was something
the
like...
The last movie is one that I've still got to tick off, but, you know, it's on the list.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In terms of other trivia for this film that we haven't talked about yet, this film was based on the book The Night the Z-Men Landed, written by Gene Janes under his pseudonym of several military books, Owen Gibson, in the 60s and published by Calvert Publishing in Sydney. There was a legal dispute between the author and McCallum Productions over the screen rights. Janes took the production company to court, holding up the release of the film, and was finally awarded rights in an out-of-court settlement. So I can understand it because I remember looking up on it before. The film did premiere at the Cannes Film Festival in 81, but it didn't come out in 82, which is kind of interesting because it would have been released hot off the heels of Mel Gibson's turn in Gallipoli, which was a huge hit the year before.
Yeah, because they started filming this like November 79, so it was a little bit before it came out. But also the script or the story was based on an actual real life commando rescue raid that was called Operation Opossum. And a team of commandos rescued the local sultan on the Japanese-held island of Ternate near Borneo. So there's a little bit of stuff that is kind of based on, and I'm guessing where the story may have been based on also.
Yep.
Well, I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, I'm kind of interested to read up more about the Z-Men, and because apparently the same people behind this film also made another film about that same unit as well later on called The Highest Honor. So I'm kind of curious to like read up more about this team and what they did during World War II. And final bit of trivia before we get to our final thoughts on the film, Attack Force Z was only released theatrically in Australia in Melbourne, where it took $88,000 at the box office after the film's release. Tim Burstall was quoted as saying, "It sold everywhere, sold over the world, and it got its money back. But it did perform the task of getting some co-productions going with the East, which was useful and very important. But it's always awful when you take over somebody else and Phil is a friend, but he really wanted to do something quite different. And I was regarded much more of a whore, I suppose." So you can at least definitely see that Tim Burstall is very honest about the fact that he was brought into this film literally at the last minute and took over from his friend Philip Noyce, and also acknowledges like Philip Noyce's film would have been a very different film than the one that he ended up making.
Yeah, and I think you can kind of see that from like with how the script is. I think there was definitely a very different movie that could have been made.
Definitely. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion on Attack Force Z. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, look, I found it was just worth a watch. Just, I guess, an interesting thing just to see like another Australian take on the war film, I suppose. It is, I mean, as of this recording, it is available to watch on Broly for free in Australia. Mm-hmm. And my rating is 3 out of 5.
And Sam, your final thoughts and a rating for the film?
I think I'd rather see the Philip Noyce version, ultimately. Like, there are some good action scenes here, but they don't mean very much because there's not much character backing them up. So it never quite comes together. There's some interest in seeing Neil and Gibson early on, but I can't help but feel that this could and should have been a better movie. Ultimately, it's 2 stars for me.
I'm going to give it slightly higher than the both of you. I'm going to give this 3.5 out of 5. Like I said, I really did enjoy it overall for what it is. Like, I could definitely see the unevenness because you could definitely tell where you could definitely see the Philip Noyce kind of influence when it came to this film, but also Tim Burstall kind of coming in at the last minute and making more of this exploitation action film, especially in the last half. But even then, though, as what it is, a Men on a Mission film, I still found it pretty enjoyable. I think the cast do all pretty solid work with their roles. And I just found kind of the sort of the bleakness of the ending just very compelling. And that's, to me, is like, if this kind of been a film where they all kind of triumphed and everything, in the end, I could have just brushed it off and then forget about it. But I don't know. I think that ending for me just really kind of just elevated the film a little bit more for me. So overall, 3.5 out of 5. Now we'll move right along to our second film, which of course is the 1982 thriller, A Dangerous Summer.
Want to burn the hotel down?
Don't worry. You and me, a great bunch.
I would do what I could to make sure that your hotel remains intact. Meanwhile, on the other hand, I'd be only too pleased to see it burned to the ground, preferably with your partner, Mr. Fane, holding the match.
And of course, you'd be in a lot better shape financially if the whole place did burn down.
Why do you say that?
Well, you're insured with our company for $10 million. But then you must know that, Mr. Anderson.
The essence of true deception is, well, it's the truth. It's the plain and simple truth. It's the only way. Yeah, well, because nobody ever believes you.
What's your province, Dave? You're an engineer or something like that?
No, I like fires.
Why'd you say that? What do you mean, you like fires?
I was being silly.
I was being silly.
Our chap lights all his fires on a Sunday. Now, you and I know that only one Sunday remains between now and the new year, and that's Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
Which is the first of 2 films directed by Quentin Masters that we're going to be talking about for this episode. The film was written by David Ambrose and Quentin Masters, based on an original idea by Kit Denton and Jim McElroy. And it stars Tom Skerritt, Ray Barrett, Ian Gilmore, Guy Dolman, Wendy Hughes, Shane Porteous, Norman Kay, Giselle Morgan, and James Mason. Sorry, I just had to do that. And the plot summary for this film from IMDb is, when a crummy hotel burns down in Australia, the American co-owner tries to find out whether or not the fire was deliberately set or just an accident. Now, Marcy, your thoughts on A Dangerous Summer.
Okay. A Dangerous Summer was meant to be a thriller, was it? Yeah, well, I honestly don't even have that much to say because I wasn't really that invested in this film. I'm not quite sure what it was that just did. I don't know. I wouldn't say it was like completely boring. I don't like using the word boring. I think it's just a bit more dull than anything else. And there is a very like strong cast, but again, I feel like it was a bit wasted. Like, you have the great James Mason, and he just was basically there. He didn't really do too much. And again, it's kind of supposed to be like a mystery about who's lighting the fires and all that, but you pretty much can work out who it is, like, and what's happening, like, pretty quickly. And this movie really put me off because at first I thought Tom Skerritt had a much younger girlfriend, and apparently it was his daughter, and that whole relationship just kind of looked and felt really icky. So it definitely lost me. With all that said, there is some positive things I can say about the film, but it's going to sound a bit weird. Because we live in a country that is prone to bushfires and stuff like that, the fire scenes are very intense. They are very scary. As a kid, my number one fear, and I'm not joking, I was so stressed as a kid from this thing that I was losing my hair. I almost went bald from stress. And it was because I used to think my house was going to burn down. Like, it was my number one fear at like 7 years old. And some of these fire scenes just took me back to being that little scared kid. So I think those are done well and effectively. I don't know what sort of movie it wants to be. And then by the end, it just feels very over the top and silly. And that kind of took away from it a little bit. But I don't know. This was weird.
And Sam, your thoughts?
Genuine question. Why are we talking about this film? On what level is it an exploitation film, really? It has some good fire stunts, or not even really fire stunts, but fire sequences. And I appreciate that because fire just looks cool on film. Incidentally, I watched Damsel on Netflix this week, which is a film with a fucking dragon in it, and there's almost no real fire in it. And it really pisses me off in modern cinema how nothing is ever on fire. When it's on fire, fire is superimposed on it and it never looks like anything's burning. It's shit. So I did appreciate that we had some good fire sequences. Other than that, what the fuck is this? I mean, it's not a very interesting mystery. Tom Skerritt looks as bored as I was. Most of it is about insurance investigation, which could be interesting. But as I say, it doesn't set up the mystery very well. It doesn't really dig into the investigation properly or interestingly. It strikes me as a very dull TV movie with a couple of good fire sequences. And even that, I mean, it's no Backdraft or anything in those terms. And yeah, Marcy's right about the relationship with his daughter. She's like 16, and the first time we see them together, he's kissing her on the lips, and it's like really fucking strange.
It just doesn't add up at all. It really doesn't.
Yeah, this was, I mean, Marcy, you split that hair between dull and boring. I'm with you. You go ahead and do that. I'm not going to. This is boring.
Well, I'm going to say it for me. This is definitely a very weird film. Like, I kind of dispute what you said before, Sam. This is definitely an exploitation film. But you got to remember, exploitation is very different from exploitation films. And this film, even the umbrella Blu-ray, which I do have here, classifies it as an exploitation film. And there are definitely elements sprinkled throughout, even though it's playing up more of this kind of mystery thriller. But I will say
it definitely like looks and feels like quite a cheaply made film as well. But also it did have an alternate title, which I have now lost and can't remember. But
it's like Flashfire. That was the
Flashfire. And that kind of sounds very exploity.
Yeah, that's a much more exploitation title and a much more exploitation cover. It's just that the film doesn't deliver those things, really.
Well, I think with me, with this film, it's definitely an odd film. Like, I don't think it entirely works as a whole, because I think it does have a very strong first half and a strong third act, but it's really the middle section I did find rather sluggish and also disjointed in terms of how it presents its mystery. But I think it's kind of more of the case of, we know who's doing it, but it's just our main characters don't, and it's them trying to figure it out. At least that's kind of the impression I got from this story.
But I think if you want to have something be a bit of a mystery, that Tom Skerritt is dealing with shady businessmen, and we know that they're kind of like responsible, but the person who's actually setting the fires, like, I feel like it's very obvious. Because this guy is dating Tom Skerritt's daughter, but Tom Skerritt is acting like his daughter is his wife. So he's like a third wheel. Yeah. Why wouldn't he be setting fires? It just felt like it was such an obvious reveal that I don't think it was very interesting there either, because it was so obvious.
Well, that's the thing. It is very obvious, but it didn't really take me out of the film, to be honest. But I guess for me, you could definitely tell both Tom Skerritt and James Mason are doing the best that they can with the material they're given. But I think for me, the kind of the standout performance is Ilmore, who does play the film's villain and the arsonist of this film, especially when he goes literally batshit insane in the last half of the film. And then when you have that sort of massive ending action set piece, where he goes to the motel and he's lighting fires everywhere. Like, I am just watching this scene and I'm like, yeah, I can definitely see why we see more CGI fire movies now, because A, it's literally insane. B, it is terrifying. And C, like, I'm not surprised that he actually hurt himself during the course of this movie, because even just the regular scenes when you have the firefighters going around trying to put out the fires and all that, to me, and I could agree with that, Marcy, because especially like here in Australia, when we have bushfires around summertime and all that, especially when we had the really bad ones a couple of years ago before the pandemic, like watching these type of scenes, I do feel a lot of intense feelings about it, because it is a very kind of triggering type of thing, seeing these fire scenes. And the fact that it is real fire definitely makes it a much more intense experience. And then when it gets to that big last set piece at the end, like, again, just the complete insanity of what is going on, and with that character of Ian Gilmore's just literally going insane to destroy this motel, and then he has his body being on fire. It's just like, those type of sequences are just insane. And
but the thing is, it felt like it was out of a completely different movie. Completely, like, by the end, Ian Gilmore's character is like, what movie do you think you're in? Where did this all come from? And as you mentioned, broke his leg during production of filming this movie.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, I think they made a dull, not very well told mystery, and then just sort of bolted this pretty good, at least pretty intense action sequence, fire sequence onto the end. It just, it doesn't feel like they belong to the same film, really. And just to clarify, it's not that I don't understand why people use CGI fire now.
Yeah.
It's just that I've never seen one use of it where it actually looks even remotely convincing. So, but I understand that you don't, as cool as full body burns are, like, I always come back to the one at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street, which is one of the great ones. But as cool as that looks, and it's obviously like super dangerous, and I understand why now that we have CGI we don't really do it anymore. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't look shit.
Yeah, it's just a very weird film. Like, it is a very totally uneven film. And I think, again, kind of like Attack Force Z, this might be a case where it was going to be start off being one thing and then became another thing during production, because one of the things I've read is that Brian Trenchard-Smith, who's a guy who we've talked about a lot on the show, was originally going to direct this film, but then he dropped out. And that's when, but what's interesting is that Brian Trenchard-Smith actually shot footage for this film. He shot the fire sequences, which were shot by John Seale, and they turned it into a 25-minute film called That Dangerous Summer, which is actually on the Blu-ray copy of the film as a special feature. Well, actually, I'm just reading here now. And then it was announced this material will be used by Trenchard-Smith for a feature film version of the story to be called Bushfire. But in the end, Trenchard-Smith did not direct. Quentin Masters came on and worked on the script with David Ambrose. And David Ambrose is someone we've actually talked about on this very show previously, because he also wrote The Survivor, which we discussed a few episodes back as well. So maybe this is another case where, like Attack Force Z, it started off as one thing with one director and then it just became a completely different film. So I wouldn't be surprised. That's probably why overall it's such a weird and uneven film.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way.
When you say that,
I
am not shocked that it's an expanded short. I'm really not.
It feels like they tried to find a story that could go with the fire stuff, but to try and make it be like, oh, let's try and make like a thriller intense thing, and it just doesn't quite work. I think
it makes me think of that sequence from Ed Wood where he's looking at all the stock footage and like, oh, I could make a movie just from this. And it's not that bad, but it's also not as charming as Ed Wood's films. So but yeah, I am not shocked by that in any way.
And I'll just add that the trivia that we discuss has been sourced from IMDb and Wikipedia.
Definitely. Definitely. Speaking of James Mason, because we were talking about him earlier, and to be honest, though, like, even though, yes, James Mason isn't given that much to do in this film, but I think he just brings his gravitas to the film, so I still enjoyed him when he was on screen.
I mean, I wasn't going to complain that he was on screen, because James Mason was a fantastic actor. But it's interesting because this is a bit of trivia that I actually didn't realize, that this was actually James Mason's second and, of course, final, because he would pass away not long, a few years after, I believe, like he did in Australia. And the first one was Age of Consent, which was several years earlier.
Which I believe is a Michael Powell film that also stars Helen Mirren.
Yep, that's so right.
And also, in terms of other trivia on this film, this movie was inspired by a number of bush ravage the outskirts of Sydney, New South Wales, Australia during the summer of 1979 and 1980. I can imagine those were the same events in which Brian Trenchard-Smith shot for that little short documentary with John
Seale. Could be that or something similar, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see that little 25-minute short just to see what that footage is and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to watch it a little bit later on the Blu-ray sometime after the show. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of A Dangerous Summer. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
It's a very weird movie. The father-daughter thing just really took me out of it as well. It just felt very creepy. It gets a 2 out of 5 from me.
And Seb, your final thoughts and rating?
I'm still not sure it belongs on this episode.
Well, it is an exploitation, so it is.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. Dull. Yeah, I mean, some good fire stunt, as we said, but otherwise, a really tedious mystery and a very long 88 minutes. Yeah, I can't recommend it. I mean, 1.5 maybe for the fire sequences, but otherwise, yeah, I mean, I would definitely rather watch the short.
Well, I liked it a little bit more than both of you, so I'm giving this about 2.5 out of 5. It is a very uneven film and a very strange film given the type of premise it has. And like you say, Marcy, that subplot with Tom Skerritt's character and his daughter was like, even I thought it's like, oh, he's his much younger girlfriend. Oh, it's his daughter. Okay, I'm creeped out by this. And they're a little too touchy-feely with each other. I don't know if I like any of this. But that being... And especially, I mean, when
he goes to pick her up at school or see her at school or whatever it is, and it's like, this is how you would act with your, like, girlfriend or wife or something. It's so...
Even later on, when he and Ian Gilmore are over at his place for Christmas dinner, it's even like that as well. They do feel more like husband and wife than father and daughter. I mean, even James Mason probably was watching this movie. He's like, I was in Lolita, and this is even more creepier than that.
I think he thought, oh, I did Lolita, and even that was more tasteful than this. And I can't do a James Mason tonight, so there we go.
That's all right. But like I said, like, there's definitely elements about this film I like. I think for most part, the cast did as well with what they were given, and some better than others. But I do think it does have some pretty solid sequences. But yeah, as a whole, it is very uneven and disjointed. But I did find it at least engaging in a lot of ways. So yeah, 2.5 out of 5 from me. Now we'll move right along to our third film for this episode. And that, of course, is the 1982 film Freedom.
When the gap becomes too wide between what you've got and what you want.
Look, I don't want to spend the rest of my life in a queue. I want to work, even if you bastards don't.
My babe. I want to get my baby back.
Who are you?
Come on, they're on to us. Quick, leave him.
No!
Sally!
Run! Get out of the way! No, I want you!
They were running away and nothing else mattered.
You stole the car, didn't you?
I told you, it's my cover.
From the South Australian Film Corporation, a new screen entertainment, Freedom. Freedom comes and freedom goes. If you let it. If you've ever dared to dream. If you've ever longed for freedom. Take the trip.
Which was directed by Scott Hicks, future Academy Award nominated director Scott Hicks, written by Josephine Emery, based on a short story also written by Josephine Emery. This film stars John Blake, Candy Raymond, Jad Kapelja, and I probably butchered your last name, so please forgive me, Chris Haywood, again, Max Cullen, Reg Lyle, and Charles Bud Tingwell. And the plot summary for this film from IMDb is... Ron, a young man in his late teens or early 20s, but emotionally younger, has no visible employable assets, yet rails at his status in life, blaming everyone for the fact that his dreams are not coming true. Now, Marcy, your thoughts on Scott Hicks's debut film, Freedom?
Well, the plot synopsis is a bit stupid because we know the character of Ron is 22.
Yes.
And yeah, look, we've talked about films being kind of uneven and it being sort of one thing and then another. And this does that again. The first part of the film feels very like it's got a purpose. And it shows like Ron, who is, he's 22, and he's kind of like a lost soul because he doesn't give too much of a shit about working, but he needs a job to have the things that he wants. And it's sort of like he has no direction. He doesn't know what he wants to do. And I kind of like that we we're seeing this. It's a young man. He's doesn't have a lot of money behind him, so he's just trying to get by and all that stuff. And there's parts where we see him try to go to a job site, and even though he's early, they look at him and like, we don't need your kind here. And then sitting at the Centrelink office waiting to talk to someone to get you a job, and they don't really care whether you do or you don't. Da, da, da. There's a lot of things in this first bit that are kind of relatable when you're that old. When you're 22, you might not know what you want to do with your life. You almost feel like you're just going through the motions at times. And I think that is very, a lot of that stuff was very relatable. And Ron kind of has these dreams of being like, I've got my fancy sports car and I'm living the life, the pretty girl and duh. And then for one day, Ron just up and steals a Porsche, and the rest of the movie is him on the run with his Porsche, and he picks up a hitchhiker who has her own problems, and I would assume she's around similar age, early 20s, and she wants to go basically kidnap her child back who was removed from the child services. So it's two lost souls on a road trip. Yeah, like this road trip, there are parts that I think are okay, but ultimately I don't think it really leads anywhere. And I felt like there was a lot more to say with the first part of the film, seeing like the struggles that Ron goes through and stuff. And I think I was much more invested in that. And then it's like this weird on the run road movie, and it doesn't have fun with it. But you understand Ron is not the perfect character. You don't need perfect characters in your film. And I just feel like they go from one thing to another that kind of makes him more and more unlikable. And I don't think that should have been the point. And then I think the ending, just again, it's an ending that I'm just like, I don't know if I really feel satisfied with this. But there's a lot of interesting things in the film in itself. I think it's really well shot, and it's got a very artsy, I guess you could say, look to it. So you can definitely see a lot of talent behind it. And I think it's an interesting story because it is based on a short story that was written by Josephine Emery, who wrote it under a male pseudonym. So it's interesting to see a male story, but told from, I guess, the female mind. So I think that kind of dynamic has some interest to it. I just think that second half really lets it down, where it feels like it's more the Roger Corman produced Ron Howard's first film, Grand Theft Auto, where the two main characters basically steal a really nice car and just go on the run and shenanigans happen. But it doesn't, it kind of felt like it was, I don't know. It's uneven, and which makes me a bit sad because I was really invested with the film to start off with. And then I think it lost me a little bit, and with the more and more stupid decisions that Ron makes. And I do think it's actually a very good performance from John Blake. He just becomes more and more unlikable, and it's hard to really empathize with him, where you could feel that more as the struggling young man. And I feel like I'm blabbing too much, so I'm going to stop.
And Sam, your thoughts on Freedom?
Yeah, I agree with Marcy to a point. I mean, we've been saying about, I think, all of these films so far that they're a little disjointed, a little uneven. They kind of feel like they're being pulled in two directions. And this is very much one of those. And it's weird because you can very much see the join here. It's a film of two halves. And I agree that the first half is vastly more interesting. Now, I don't know what you guys know, because, I mean, this is just before you guys were born, obviously, that this is made. But I obviously have no handle on the economic situation in Australia in the early 80s. But this, to me, feels like a film that is exploring and indicting that in its first half. I don't know whether it's because I saw a YouTube copy of this, but as good as the film looks, it often looks very dingy. The town settings in particular are a bit broken down. It looks like the wrong side of the tracks. With the exception of the Porsche that he steals, a lot of the cars are kind of battered. Everything's a bit dirty and crappy looking. Even when we get to the impressive vistas of the second half, they're often shot in what looks to me, and again, this might be just the copy that I saw, but what looks to me like kind of overcast conditions. So it's not really showing off the sort of majesty of Australia to me. It's sort of about people scraping by, and I feel like it even reflects that in the settings. And I think it does that really effectively in the first half. There's not much wrong. I mean, he could be more invested in his jobs, don't get me wrong, but there's not much wrong with the way that Ron is going about his work. He's working at a car shop, basically, at the beginning. And he seems to be just getting on with his job like anyone else, getting a bit on the side for himself, maybe, but again, not in any serious way. And it doesn't seem like anyone knows about that when he gets let go. So it's not about that. So I think him feeling hard done by is not unearned at the beginning of the film. I think it really interestingly explores that up to a point. And then he sees the Porsche, and it's connected to a girl who sort of used to be the girl next door. And he steals it not from her, but from her older boyfriend. We hear a phone conversation that sort of implies that she's what we might term a sugar baby now. And then he just sort of takes off with the car, and it turns into, it references Bonnie and Clyde, but it's more sort of leaning on Badlands, I think. But with, there's no murder involved, to be fair. And he picks up Jad Capellia, but I don't find her terribly interesting. I think they do their best to develop that character. And I think as a sort of independent character, she's more interesting. But in the relationship that they develop between her and Ron isn't particularly compelling. I don't think it's a problem that Ron's an asshole and that he gets worse and more self-centered throughout the film, because I feel like that's what the film is saying, that he's like taking his freedom back, taking his power back from this system that is not necessarily screwing him over, but perhaps, and I, as I said, I don't know about the economic situation, but perhaps not in a position to help him and to set him up for maybe the life that his parents had. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on politically, and then it kind of abandons it for some really great car stunts. But it's kind of a shame that what lies behind the film kind of disappears in the second half, as cool as the stunts are. And they are very cool.
Yeah, I agree. And I think part of what really drew me into that first part is because this film is actually the first theatrical feature film from the South Australian Film Corporation that was entirely written and directed by South Australians. And that was... it was the first since the inception of the South Australian Film Corporation in 1973. So again, it's the first part is set around Adelaide and the suburbs and growing up in South Australia and Adelaide. A lot of things looked familiar, but a lot of things have changed since then as well. That kind of drew me in, and being that young age and being a bit of a lost soul was very relatable, even though the situations are a bit different. But there was something there that kind of, you know, resonated with me, but the film kind of lost that when it goes on to this road trip. But Pete.
This is my least favorite film of the ones we're talking about for this episode. Honestly,
strangely, the one we just talked about, A Dangerous Summer, was my least favorite.
Well, I do agree. I think the first half is definitely the strongest when you have the character of Ron and him trying to find work and then getting knocked back and him having these dreams of wanting to get a Porsche. Like, those scenes are definitely very relatable. And I do agree. I like visually how the film looks in this first half because of how dingy everything looks. It almost kind of feels like almost like a Ken Loach film at times in this first half, especially when it kind of portrays the sort of the mundane kind of downtrodden nature of what of its main character and him trying to find work. And again, Marcy, I think you mentioned this to me earlier, just those scenes of him being in the job office, I'm just getting traumatic experiences being in the job office, especially if you have to go there. And if you don't have an appointment, you could be sitting there waiting for hours until you see someone and they barely help you out. So that first act in particular, I do think is the strongest, but as the film goes on, I just found it an absolute slog. And in this one, like the two previous films we discussed, is also very uneven and disjointed, especially in the second half. And I don't know, I just did not find it compelling. And the fact that it literally just goes from one scene to another, and I just completely stopped caring after a while. And you're right as well that Ron as a character, like, you do sympathize with him a lot in the first half, but then once he gets the Porsche and basically goes on the run and then meets Sally, then yeah, he just becomes incredibly unlikable after that. And I think
I could go with it up until the point where, this is towards the end of the film, where Ron literally just leaves her while she's asleep. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't feel like you're redeemable anymore. But then by the end, he's like, oh, I've got a friend to pick up. And it's like, well, I fucking hope so, you dickhead.
Well, that's the thing though. I think where the film goes in the end, because he keeps having this dream. Every time he has his dreams of being in a Porsche with a naked lady and stuff like that, he also sees like a black car kind of swerving in front of him, and then it goes off the side of a cliff and crashes, and then he finds that he's on that same road and then finds that car at the bottom of a hill, and then he gets rid of the Porsche. And I could definitely see what they were going for in this scene, because the one thing that he wanted as his escape is a Porsche, and basically once he got that Porsche, his whole life pretty much just went downhill right away, because he's on the run from the police, he's getting caught up in so much trouble. So in a way, it's symbolic of him realizing that this car is not what he actually wants. So by getting rid
of it, the ending to me suggests that the slate is wiped.
Yeah.
At the end of the film, because the police know the car, but not him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think the title is there both in reference to the Porsche and in reference to the very ending.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, even then though, as much as I did like that very last scene, I just found myself bored a lot through this film. And even at this 100 minutes, it just went on and on. And I had to stop and start this movie a whole bunch of times because I just kept losing interest after a few minutes and then had to go do something and then come back and finish it. I don't know. Again, I think it starts off strong, but then it kind of goes downhill very fast as it goes along. And also a lot of the actors who are in this film, like Charles Bud Tingwell and actors we've mentioned before on the show, like Chris Haywood and Max Cullen, like some of them are literally only on screen for like 10 seconds and we never see them again in the rest of the film.
But that's just the structure of this film though. It's really, I mean, it's largely a one character piece, yeah. But in the second half, a two character piece.
Yeah.
So, I think it's an unfair criticism to say these people who are high billed are not in it for very long, because otherwise you're only billing three people at best. Because I don't know if we really mentioned Candy Raymond, who plays the girl next door figure in the first half. She's actually really interesting, and like I'd have liked to have known more about her life. Like there's an entire side movie that can be made about that character, and that's one of the things that I think is really interesting about the first half. Like you could spin that movie off in a couple of different ways and it would still be like pretty interesting, I think.
But I guess for me, all these different side characters, like if they were part of the film more, I feel like the film would have been more interesting. But the fact that the movie kind of only touches upon them for a little bit and then spins off to a different part of the story, it basically just made the film just less satisfying as a whole. But I think what's interesting about Jad Capalia, who plays Sally, and with her teaming up with Ron and going on the run, what I think is interesting, though, and I didn't realize this, is that this is only one of two films that she did, and then she pretty much quitted acting. She only did this film. She did Puberty Blues, and that was the film that kind of broke her out. Then if you did a few episodes of A Country Practice, and that was it. She never acted again after these projects. I'm not sure why, but that's what happened.
Sometimes that happens, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. But also...
Oh, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, like, even though technically this is Scott Hicks's debut film, but I should have stated earlier this is his debut feature-length film because he did direct two other films prior to this one, but they were short feature films, which were The Wanderer and Down the Wind. So those are kind of technically his first films, but again, if we're going by feature-length productions, Freedom is his first one, for sure. And then, of course, like I said, he's an Oscar-nominated director and would go on to get nominated for the film Shine in 1996. But also interesting, like a few films we've discussed on this very show, and I'm reading this from trivia, is the movie was available on home video during the early 80s, but after its theatrical release, it was not released on DVD in Australia until 2019.
This is why physical media matters, and we shouldn't just leave things on fucking VHS.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly. And also, and I'm glad you put this down in the trivia, Marcy, is that this was the debut music score soundtrack composed and produced by Don Walker of Australian rock band Cold Chisel. And when I saw his name in the credits, Marcy, I'm just thinking, like, Don Walker, one of the members of Cold Chisel, and then I had to look it up, like, oh, it is Don Walker.
Yep, it certainly was.
It was a good score. I have to say, like, even though I'm not hot on this movie at all, I will say the score for this film is definitely one of the highlights for me.
It was a good score.
Definitely. And as you were saying before, this film was written by Josephine Embry under the pseudonym of John Emery. And Josephine Emery believed that all men create fantasies to live by. Many never escape from them while others fight hard to escape from them. Emery also believed very strongly that the media reinforced these illusions and fantasies, strengthening the trap, which I could definitely sense in that first act of the film in terms of how Ron kind of sees this Porsche as like his way out of how stuck he feels about his life.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think it kind of, you can go into sort of like how, and this isn't in Australia, but I'm looking at it like how America is like the American dream. And it's like something that's so like unattainable, but you get it in movies and blah, 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 that reinforce an illusion of something. And I think that's kind of, yeah, I would say that's kind of the same thing as where this was sort of a same idea kind of thing.
Yeah. But I guess that could be a wrap of this discussion of Freedom. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
Look, it's a very decent, I guess, debut theatrical feature film from Scott Hicks. And there's certainly a lot to get out of this film. I just think it's that weird road trip part of the film that I think loses me a little bit, but I give it a solid 3 out of 5.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating on Freedom?
Yeah, spoilers, other than the one I'd already seen, which we'll get to in a minute, this is easily my favorite film on the show today. And it's largely because of that first half, which is really interesting, throws up a lot of really interesting social issues and ideas like social history. And like you said, rather loach in approach at times. And I think in and of itself, the second half is actually really strong. And I may have talked myself around to a higher rating and certainly picking this up at some point. I just don't know that the two films belong as the same film all the time, and that's why it's probably 3 stars for me. But I think this is the one of the stuff I hadn't seen before that I would really recommend that people seek out.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give this film 2 out of 5. It just, as a whole, it didn't really quite work for me. I think the first half, like I stated before, is definitely the strongest one, especially with how it kind of portrays the hardships of trying to find a job, being young and having dreams and just feeling unfulfilled by life. But once Ron gets that Porsche and goes on the run, it just lost interest for me, and it kind of just became such a uneven, disjointed bore fest for the rest of the film. And again, like a lot of like what we talked about with the two previous films, it just feels like at times it just goes from one scene to the other. And after a while, I just stopped caring about what was going on. Like, visually, the film looks good, and I did like the score, and I did like the ending as well and what it had to say. But yeah, this is a film where the sum of the parts are definitely better than the whole. So 2 out of 5 from me. Now, we'll move right along to our next film, which I would say is the big film of this episode. And that, of course, is the 1982 psychological horror film, Next of Kin.
Linda survive the nightmare that threatens her sanity? Fans of gothic horror will not be disappointed.
Which was directed by Tony Williams, written by Michael Heath and Tony Williams. It stars Jackie Curran, John Jarrett, Alex Scott, Gerda Nicholson, Charles McCallum, and Bernadette Gibson. And the plot summary for this film from IMDb is, in a rest home for elderly people, a daughter reads her mother's diary. Soon events that are mentioned in her mother's diary begin to happen to the daughter. Marcy, now, I know out of all the films on this episode of the show, this is one you have seen before. So tell us your thoughts on your recent rewatch of Next of Kin.
Yeah, I first watched it a few years ago for 31 Days of Horror, and it was easily one of my favorites that I saw for that block of films. And upon rewatch, it still completely holds up for me. And Next of Kin, it is the Ozploitation giallo film. It has that feel of a giallo, you get that, but it's like not at the same time. And because it's not an Italian made film, but it's certainly got some feels of the 70s giallo, and there's a bit of a mystery there. And I think you can kind of figure it out as it goes along because you see the clues. But I just think everything about it is just really well done. I think it's very well directed. I think it's a very, really good script, a bit of mystery in there. And I really like the main performance from Jackie Curran as the main person whose mother has passed away, and she sort of takes over the rest home for the elderly people. But there's a lot of scenes that are a bit, like, I don't want to say frightening, but maybe shocking. And you're in a rest home for elderly people, so you can imagine people are going to pass away, and that happens. But then there's like this deeper mystery that unwraps itself, and you can kind of work it out, as I said. But I don't think if you've worked it out, it kind of takes away from it, because I think it's just really well built up and there's a lot of atmosphere. It's just something about this film. I think it's just one of the best that Australian filmmaking you can get, especially within the genre. It's a very special film, and definitely, as you said, it's like the big one for this episode and probably the one most people would have heard of, at least. For me, it's almost one of a kind. I just think it's great. It's almost hard to just like gather my thought, because it's just such a great film.
And Sam, your thoughts on Next of Kin?
Yeah, I don't know that I agree that it's one of a kind. Not to denigrate it in any way, but I think it wears a lot of its influences on its sleeve. Like you said, there's a lot of giallo influence here. Argento definitely comes through at times. I'm thinking of like the shot of Barney being thrown out of that wheelchair at the end. Feels like it's straight out of an Italian horror film of a similar period. It also has, I think, shades of repulsion to it and other more sort of psychological horror. So I think you can definitely see the antecedents of this film in it. So I don't know that I agree there. I do think it's superb, though. 1982 was a real banner year for cinema as a whole, certainly, but particularly genre cinema, sci-fi horror, teen sex comedies. And I feel like this absolutely belongs in that discussion. Is it right up there with The Thing? Yeah, maybe not, but I think it belongs in that discussion of like 82 as a real banner year for horror cinema in particular. Jackie Caron, I think, is really good here. I think she has a lot of, particularly towards the end of the film, a kind of Shelley Duvall in The Shining energy to her, where she's becoming unhinged in a way that feels really visceral and somewhat realistic, actually. And I think that really works for the film. But also in the first half, even though you can feel that there's something off, or could be convinced that there is, not to give much away, I think her scenes with John Jarrett, who plays Barney, who is basically her love interest, really ground the film in a realistic relationship between these two people, which is important because right from the beginning, we're getting these beautiful in-camera cuts that could be taking us between dream and reality, could be taking us between past and present. We're never quite sure until we get to the unraveling of the mystery at the end of the film. It's really stylish. I don't know why Tony Williams, who this is his second feature, he had done a TV movie and some shorts before. He didn't direct another film until 2013. This appears to be the only even approaching genre film on his filmography. He did some work as a cinematographer as well, but again, not much. And notably, this appears to be the only, he seems to have photographed all the films that he's directed since Next of Kin, but not Next of Kin itself. It's a beautiful looking film. It's stylish and nasty at times, quite visceral. A great car stunt at the end, just because this is the car stunt episode, it seems. And yeah, there's really a lot to recommend. I think you can also see films that have been influenced by this as well. I think I would be stunned if Jennifer Kent didn't use it as a reference for The Babadook in terms of slipping between dream and reality, between those sort of state, and maybe even for Essie Davis' performance. So I think it's not just a really good film, but one that's worth seeing, because I think it's pretty important too, ultimately.
Yeah, my thoughts on Next of Kin. I'm just going to say it right off the bat. I absolutely love this movie. The first time I watched it was about 11 years ago for my 31 Days of Horror, and I watched it and I really enjoyed it a lot. And then when the movie came out on Blu-ray by Umbrella, I picked it up and rewatched it again. And that would have been like 6 years ago. But the interesting thing about the film is there's so many aspects about the film that I remember so vividly. But I have to admit, even though I had already seen this movie before, where it went in the third act caught me off guard again. Because I completely forgot that's where the story goes in the third act. And I was just surprised. I'm like, else did I forget this insane third act? I've seen the movie before, but I guess because I just completely forgot about it. But what I really love about this film, and it definitely has a lot of Italian horror influence throughout, and I know you both have said Dario Argento was definitely an influence on this film, but
like some Fulci in there.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I got more Fulci vibes from this film than Argento, to be honest. But yeah, it is such a creepy and atmospheric film. And I love the fact that it kind of plays what type of film you think it's going to be. Is this a psychological horror of someone slipping into madness? Is this a haunted house story? Is this a weird, almost David Lynch type surreal horror film? Or is it a slasher film? Or is it a giallo?
I think the key to its success is that the answer to all those questions is yes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, it is all those things. It is a mixture of all those things. And that's what I think makes it such a really interesting and memorable horror film. Because it, like, at the top, when this film kind of came out, no Australian horror film was like this. And Marcy, we've talked about a lot of them for this show so far. But this one, I would say, even this early in the Ozploitation movement, this is still one of the more unique Australian horror films. And
it's one, probably the one that is like most mesmerizing and very memorable, because it's the kind of film that sticks with you. And I think a lot of the other horrors we had seen didn't have like this kind of vibe. They were kind of going off more like American slashes and stuff that we've seen. Even though something like Night of Fear, which might be one of the only Terry Burks I actually thought was really good. I mean, that was almost a pre-Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So there was definitely like some very interesting horror. I just don't think it got to a point, at least in this area, until this, with something very different and unique. I think Thirst gets close.
Yeah. With that kind of mixture of so many different genres that it's tackling within its story. And I also got to say, like, I want to give a big kudos to Gary Hanson, who was the cinematographer on this film. This movie looks spectacular, and there's so many shots in this film that are burnt into my mind. Like the scene where Linda is in the forest with Barney, and then she thinks she sees Barney in the distance, and you see this figure just standing in the middle of these trees just watching her. And I don't know what it is about that shot in particular, but it just really creeps me out. And also just the shot of when later on towards the ending, when she's running out of her bedroom, it goes into extreme slow-mo and her screams get so distorted, and the camera's like overhead as she's running down the hallway, and then it just goes into this fisheye camera lens as she's going down the stairs. And also, even before that shot is where she's just running to go find Barney, and it's just like pitch black, and it's like you see like this little figure just running across this field. And it's, there are so many amazing shots throughout this film, and I just think it's so spectacular. But also Klaus Schultz, who was a member of Tangerine Dream, did the score for this film. And I think his score really adds so much layers of that, just makes the film more moody and unsettling as well. And I got to tell you this, Marcy, because I don't know if you know about this, but Harry, the guy who owns the cafe at the beginning of the film, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you recognize who that is?
I actually probably already knew this, but my mind is blank at the moment.
Do you remember back in the 90s, the Yellow Pages ad. He was the guy who was on the phone talking about his GoMobile.
Yes, I knew it was something like that. I know we had this discussion. I just couldn't remember.
Yeah,
but he got a mobile that went go through his front window there.
A broken fret. Problem with my GoGoMobile. GoGoMobile. Problem with my GoGoMobile. And I was wondering if G-O-G-G-O. Problem with my GoGoMobile. And yeah?
Yeah? No, not the dark. Not the dark. So they always think it's the dark. It's a weird ripper.
Exactly. And, but I just think it's such a spectacular film. I think Jackie Curran. And you know what, Sam? You're right. She definitely has a lot of Shelley Duvall energy from The Shining in this film. And I think it's interesting you say that, because one person who is a huge fan of this film is Quentin Tarantino, and he says that it's one of his favorite Australian films. He has described this film as mesmerizing, adding that the film's pacing and atmosphere are comparable to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. And I can definitely see that. I mean, I don't think Next of Kin is exactly has the same feel as The Shining, but I could definitely see what he means, though, because it has a vibe to it that is just so unique and just different. And even from beginning to end, you just feel unsettled. Even in scenes where nothing creepy is happening, you just feel unsettled. And also, Marcy, also the friend of Linda's, the one in the car with Barney. That was Pippa from Home and Away.
Oh, there she is again.
Yes. And it's like literally like within 48 hours of seeing her also in Ricky's Stinicky. So there you go.
It makes sense to me that the score is by a member of Tangerine Dream, because now that I think about it, yes, that's exactly what it sounds like. But I was going to mention it is a great score, and it really adds to the atmosphere of the film, this sort of early synth creepiness without being the sort of the retro synth scores that were all over horror about 5 years ago. And I had some time for a lot of them, but this sort of real early 80s synth score, yeah, it lends it a very peculiar atmosphere. And I think it's one of the key reasons that it's so successful. But two things I don't know that I mentioned. First of all, Bede, you said you've got the umbrella disc of this. So have I, because you recommended it. Yep. And it was a blind buy for me. So yeah, that one's on you, and a very good nod it was too. The other thing, you were on my show recently. Yes. It won't be out by the time this one comes out, but Bede was on our episode of Fearless Pretender on a film called Sister. And we do this thing at the end of the show where we pick a film that would double bill well with the Jennifer Jason Leigh film that we've been discussing, but which Jennifer Jason Leigh isn't in. And I can't remember what you picked, Bede.
Let's see. I did pick Stoker. That was one. And also Eve's Bayou.
That's correct. Okay. Also Next of Kin. I thought a lot of Sister while I was watching this movie this time, particularly in the way it likes rain towards the end of the film. There's some very similar shots of the way that rain is reflected down the walls of the old people's home in this case, and the sort of the hotel in Sister. And I feel like a lot of its vibes are similar. If only I had got round to doing the research for this before we had recorded that, I might have ended up picking it myself.
But also, I think what's interesting about this film, and you touched upon this before, Marcy, is this movie can be very nasty with its violence, which does feel almost very Italian horror, where nothing happens, and then when the violence does hit, it like is so visceral in how it's portrayed.
Yeah, I think we get that a lot with the reveal when we're still in the house. It felt very Italian, Giallo-esque, and I think when we get to that final bit as well, just with the, I guess, killer character, he's just so, like, deranged at this point. Again, it reminds me of, like, reveals in a giallo, that it's, like, you kind of know, but you don't know at the same time. It's a weird one. Like, I kind of worked it out, but it still is, like, it still surprises you in a way that I think I like about Giallo films with the reveal. So a lot of that reminded me of that, but I think just that it's a very, like, unhinged performance from the actor who I can't remember who it is.
I had to do a double take with that character of, I believe it was Kelvin, played by Robert Ratty. I honestly thought it was the same actor from A Dangerous Summer because they looked very similar.
Yeah, but I think this kind of unhinged worked for this movie, whereas I don't think that one worked for that movie in particularly. But there's, yeah, it's just a great, great film. And I know we keep saying it's like it's Australian film, but it was written and directed by Kiwis, according to the New Zealand on-screen website. And it was ultimately shot and set in Australia because it was filmed during an extremely hot summer in Victoria.
Indeed, indeed.
And this movie actually won some awards as well. So.
It did. It was actually only nominated for one Australian Film Industry Award, which was Best Editing, but it lost out to Mad Max 2 The Road Warrior. And it's hard not to understand that because it is Mad Max 2 The Road Warrior. But I think what's interesting, though, it's because we talked about this as well, because this film and also the other film we talked about on a previous episode when we got together, which is Dead Kids, it's like they're New Zealand co-productions being shot in different places, but yet they do have their own kind of feel. And I think having a New Zealand director and writers work on this film with an Australian cast and setting, I guess having that sort of outsider perspective kind of brings something askew when it comes to how they approach this story, because it does feel like an outsider's perspective when it comes to this Australian small town life when you watch it. But I think also one bit of trivia I love about this film, and another great shot in this film I might add, is when at the end, when Linda and the young boy leave the cafe before it explodes, and the camera kind of goes around slowly and we hear the cafe explode and then the camera's on it. What's interesting about that shot is that wasn't supposed to happen. What was meant to happen in that scene is that as the car was driving off, the camera was meant to go around and got onto the cafe, that's when it would explode, but it exploded early. Instead of doing the scene again, Tony Williams loved what happened in that moment so much that he just kept it in the film.
It works. It works. Yeah. Another interesting bit of trivia, apparently, I don't think this film did that well at the time here, but I believe at the, I can't pronounce the name, the
Sticks.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, it got Best Director ahead of Sam Raimi for The Evil Dead, apparently.
That's got very surprising.
And it was also a winner of the Grand Prize Golden Unicorn Award at the International Festival of Fantastic and Science Fiction Films in France. So yes, it did win some awards.
Yeah, I can imagine this would be a film that would have flopped in Australia, but was embraced when it went over to other countries of the world, especially in Europe. But also, what I
can imagine it doing better over there, because I think they understand the kind of film that it is.
Oh, exactly. Although I kind of want to see the earlier version of this movie, because apparently an early draft of this script, it was meant to be more of a black comedy.
I don't know if that would have worked, to be fair.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of curious because I know I wrote about this in my old column, Horror Down Under, for the screencast. So I might have to dish that out and find out, because I think I did dive into that a little bit for that column. But I can definitely see that. But I think having it a straight horror film definitely makes it work overall. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Next to Kin, because we could easily talk about this film for quite a while. But Master, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Look, it's pretty simple. If you haven't seen this film and you're interested in seeing it, at least in Australia, it is available on several streaming services for free. So you can always check it out. But yeah, for me, it's like a 4.5 out of 5 film. I just think it's fantastic. I really enjoy this movie a lot.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for Next of Kin?
Yeah, I mean, I went for a blind buy on this on a friend's recommendation. Don't know who that was. And it really worked out for me. So I would absolutely suggest that people do the same. I don't think it's available in the UK, but, you know, if you can import the Umbrella Blu-ray, it's got some very good stuff on it and it's well worth the time. Honestly, I think it's one of the sort of under the radar great horror films of 82, which is, as I said, a real huge year for the genre. So get on this. It's probably 4 stars for me, but, you know, that's not to do it down in any way.
I would even say, like, if you can't get your hands on the Umbrella Blu-ray, I believe Severin in the US also released it on Blu-ray as well. So you could also get it there too. But for me personally, I'm giving this my highest rating. This film gets 5 stars for me. I absolutely love it. And the more times I watch it, the more and more I just love it even more. And I love the fact that it is basically an Australian take on a giallo / Italian horror film.
Sorry, allow me to correct myself. There is a Second Sight Blu-ray in the UK.
Okay. Nice. Well, it's easy to get anywhere, depending on where you live in the world. So, but yeah, I just do love this movie so much. I think it's so incredibly unsettling, atmospheric, and when you watch it the first time, you're kind of intrigued about where it's going to go with its story, because it does throw in so many twists and turns throughout it. And the acting is fantastic. And there's so many memorable moments throughout all of it. And I do love the fact that over the last few years, this film is starting to get more and more love, especially because, like we have stated before, it's now easy to buy this film on Blu-ray, and a few streaming services like Shudder and a few others have been playing it on their services and here in Australia, so people can see it. I love the fact that this film is now out there, because like a few films that we talked about, until it was released on Blu-ray a couple of years ago, this film was very hard to find. I think the first time I watched this film was on YouTube, as a matter of fact. So that was the only place where you could actually watch the film. And so if you haven't seen Next of Kin, definitely seek it out. But we'll move right along to our fifth and final film for this episode. And that, of course, is the 1983 action film Midnight Spares.
What'd you get?
3.
Volvo?
Yeah, Volvo.
Fantastic.
Midnight Spares. Stealing, stripping. It's a million-dollar racket run by corrupt and powerful men.
You bastard!
No one stands in their way. Except a boy and a girl who want to be free.
Look, Mum, I love him.
We want to get married.
Steve's a racer. Ruth, 16. Their friends don't make the social pages.
Well, you're fighting the cat, you should get out in the rain. I'll give you a bit of a wash.
But they want to make an honest dollar.
Hey, finger!
The mob have other ideas.
You work for us or you don't work.
Don't get angry, Steve. Get even.
They're closing in. There's nothing to lose.
I thought we were going to stick it up them.
It's time to even the score.
Trying to be smart, eh?
Go!
What's this?
Which was directed by Quentin Masters, our second one for this very episode. This film is written by Terry Larson, and it stars James Lurie, Gia Carides, Bruce Spence, an actor who we talk a lot on this show. Once again, Max Cullen, David Argu, Tony Barry, John Godden, John Clayton, Jonathan Coleman. That's a lot of Johns right there. And another actor who we talk about a lot on this show, Graham Blundell. And the plot summary for this film is, after discovering that a group of car thieves may have something to do with his father's untimely death, Steve pursues the criminals and attempts to capture them, as well as prove his prowess as a race car driver. Now, Marcy, I know you're a bit of a rev head. Or at least, like, in terms of movies about cars, that seems to be your...
Is it, though? I mean, not by choice, but, like, all of these movies, or at least, like, three and a bit of these movies, just happen to have a lot of car stuff on them. I don't know if that makes me a rev head, though, Bean.
I think it's getting close, though, Marcy. And especially because, like, Max Cullen, I'm going to ask you, Marcy, what was the deal with Max Cullen being in so many of these car movies in the Ozploitation genre?
I don't know. Maybe it was just the choice of film roles that came up.
Exactly.
Because there were just so many car movies.
Indeed. But tell us your thoughts on Midnight Spares.
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed this one, and I wasn't sure if I was going to. In the end, this was just a fun ride of a film. Like, I didn't mind the characters at all. I was very much, like, behind the main character of the film and his little journey and trying to work out, like, what happened to his dad and stuff. But then we've also got on the side, there's a whole group of, like, car thieves and stuff like that. And I think when it finished, I sort of said to my housemate, it's kind of like the original Gone in 60 Seconds if it wasn't completely boring, because I just found there was something interesting going on. I liked the characters, and again, there's a lot of stunts and craziness going on, but at the end I had a fun time with the film, and I actually quite liked it. It's not like a full serious movie or anything. This very much feels like an Oscar type movie. I just can't quite put my finger on it. Something about it just was for me. And I kind of wish we had a bit more flair with A Dangerous Summer. I felt like this one had all the fun injected into it way more than that one did. I mean, it's about fires. It's not meant to be fun, but you know what I mean. I quite like this movie.
Well, I also forgot, because I forgot to mention him in the cast, because I only just saw his name just now. Terry Camilleri?
Camilleri?
Yeah, he was in The Cars That Ate Paris, because he was the lead of that movie. And I think I also mentioned later on that he was also played Napoleon in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yes, and this movie actually does have quite a number of people in the cast. Even someone like Bruce Spence, who is not like a main character, but is still there. And for some reason, he's just as dirty looking as he was in Mad Max 2.
Bruce Spence is the unofficial mascot for this podcast, Marcy, because I think he has been in more films that we have talked about on this show than any other actor.
That is quite possible.
I don't know if Bruce Spence has been in any of the ones that I've seen, because he is the weirdest looking dude.
And that's why we love him.
that guy wasn't born. He was extruded.
I mean, he's like 8 feet tall. Okay, he's not 8 feet tall, but he's a very tall person. And he's like quite a character actor, because we've seen him in, like, he's been in non-Australian stuff, obviously. And he's got just that recognizableness to him, but he's a very, like, unique looking person. So it's easy to see why he just kind of gets cast in some bizarre roles as well.
Oh, exactly. But Sam, your thoughts on Midnight Spares?
Yeah, aside from, God, that's a weird-looking dude. Not that I can. This is a fantastic fucking stunt show. Like, really incredible. All of the car stunts are amazing. The race is great. I watched a film for Fearless Pretender called Grandview USA, which is set around a demolition derby.
Mm.
And there's some sequences that remind me of that film here. I think they're better executed here, because that's not really like a stunt-driven film, whereas this very much is. Where this doesn't excel is in the character stuff for me. Like, the cast are memorable in that they're sort of memorable looking, Spence, but also there's some real, like, character actor faces in here. And I believe this was Gia Carida's debut.
Yes, it was.
And she immediately is just strikingly beautiful and has some level of presence as well. What I don't think she has is any detectable chemistry with James Laurie. And that's a real problem because we're definitely meant to invest in that relationship.
And it feels like that's been a bit of an issue with a few of these films, is that the chemistry between the characters just isn't there. Because I agree, I don't feel like there was a believable chemistry between those two characters. And I could have dealt with them as being friends rather than knowing each other for a week and wanting to get married.
Yeah, like that. It makes no sense, either script or like just pure chemistry level. Mm. Like they don't establish that relationship well. The two never look like a couple. Mm. The idea that they're going to get married is absolutely laughable. And yeah, it would have been absolutely fine, because there's also, it feels like there's quite an age gap between them. And it would have been absolutely fine if they'd sort of been friends and he was like showing her cars because she was interested or something. I think that would have worked perfectly well. But this, you know, whole relationship story does nothing for me. And I think it also, like some of the other films that we've talked about here, doesn't really integrate its mystery or sort of background story particularly well. I wasn't particularly compelled by what happened to his father. I don't think it's a very interesting storyline, and really all it becomes is an excuse to smash up more cars, which, fine, great, you know, and that is what this film does well, is smash up cars. So any excuse for it to do that. But like I said, it's a really good stunt show that could use a more interesting screenplay to back it up for me.
Yeah, well, I think for me, I enjoyed the film overall for what it is. But I do agree, I think the mysteries about what happened to the father, I think, is kind of the least interesting aspect of the film. Like, we kind of just know the answer even before we find out that he was killed. We kind of just make that assumption, and we know, when we meet all the sort of the bad guys throughout this film, including Graham Blundell, who I just giggling to myself because his character's name is Sidebottom. I'm even sure, what can I say?
He looks like a swampy little rat in this movie.
Yeah.
And he manages to play that really well.
Yeah, he looked like he was like sweaty. He was so nervous on screen.
And it was just a very small, just weird role. Let's just put Graham Blundell in there. It's like, okay, then.
Exactly. But I did enjoy the main plot, which is basically Steve wanting to become a race car driver. That to me was kind of the more interesting one, especially with his relationship with all the oddball characters around him. I do agree that he and Giacarides, I don't really buy their chemistry. I think Giacarides is great in this film. I really enjoyed her a lot. And James Laurie he's fine, but he's definitely the kind of the stiff straight man compared to all the madness that is the supporting cast.
Yeah, I did like him in the film though. And I felt like Steve was quite a likable character. I think what let him down was, there's the romance stuff's not believable, but also the mystery with the dad, I don't think really factors in all that much. So they focused on that a little bit too much, because I think he does well when he's hanging out with the crew and working on the car and all that stuff.
Exactly. And the car stunts are pretty great, and especially in the last half of the film where it's just like literally batshit insane. All those sequences in particular are pretty good. And it's kind of interesting kind of watching these two films from Quentin Masters throughout this episode, even though this one also kind of suffers similarly to A Dangerous Summer, that the plot is a bit disjointed and trying to do a whole lot of things. But I think this one compared to that one is much more consistent with its tone. And it doesn't feel like both these films are from the same director.
No, not at all.
But I do like the supporting cast. I love Bruce Spence and David Argue as Wimpy and Rabbit. I love their interplay with each other, and they just play their characters so over the top. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, like, why aren't Bruce? I mean, granted, Bruce Spence is a very tall guy, so I can imagine him like wanting to eat 10 hot dogs in a row.
Really wanted to eat a lot of hot dogs in this movie.
Exactly. And also, I really enjoyed also Max Cullen as Tomas. Like, this is our third recent film with Max Cullen. So it's like funny between this film, Freedom, which we talked about earlier, and also Running on Empty, not the Cynthia Lumet one that we talked about on the previous episode. Like, he's played three different characters, and he actually does a good job at playing these three different distinct characters.
Yeah, very distinct characters, and I think that he's a very good character actor, and he's very good in this as well. I think I liked most of the cast, to be fair.
Yeah, I would say, like, the cast stunts and the acting do elevate the film. Like, I think if those aspects weren't as strong for me as they were, I think the film would be not as enjoyable as it is. But I think that overall is what made me invested with the film.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the cast are fun, and there's some, like I said, some just colourful character actor faces in here. Don't think they have enough that's particularly interesting to do, ultimately. But they are memorable faces, certainly.
Yeah, definitely.
And I was going to mention, like, this has come up a few times, and obviously regulations and stuff would change, so this would not happen or try to avoid it happening. But the focus puller, David Rostoff, was killed during the making of the film, and the film, in the opening credits, has a dedication in memory of David Rostoff.
And we do mention that because at this time, in terms of stunts, especially car stunts in films, Australia had a bit more kind of free reign when it came to these stunts. And I think it was this film, and our previous guest on the show, Pete, who hosts Digo 8 by Movie, mentioned this as well, that because of what happened on this film, like when it came to stunts in future Australia productions, they made a lot of big changes and make more safety precautions.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the, I mean, again, back to Dear Grant Page, did some very insane, very dangerous stunts. And we've seen some films that have had, like, very dangerous stunts as well. And I think because rules and regulations came in, some films then decided to shoot elsewhere because they could do whatever they wanted, and that's very dangerous.
Definitely. And also, this wasn't in the trivia, but I do know for a fact that this film, like Freedom and a few other films, until it was released by Umbrella on Blu-ray, I think that was like the first time it had been released on any home media since the 80s. Because I remember when we were doing research for this episode, I did buy the film, but I think the copy I had, which was on DVD, might have been like a bootleg of the film, which I did own. And then, of course, once Umbrella announced this Blu-ray, like, I just chucked that bootleg out and got the real deal. So, yeah, this was also another film that took a very long time to actually get a proper home media release as well.
Which I'm glad.
I've got to say.
This
is where I really value people who are archiving stuff like this online as well, because I come and do this show when I can, and we always have to source the films pretty much online for me. I had the Blu-ray for Next of Kin for this, and there's been a few others that I've had on disc, which has sometimes been why those have been the episodes I've been on. But a lot of the time, we just have to source them where we can, whether it's Internet Archive, whether it's YouTube, which it was for a lot of these. And I am very much a champion of physical media. I have 5,500 discs in my room at the moment. But there is absolutely also a place for places like Internet Archive, for places like YouTube, where people are uploading these otherwise essentially lost or underseen movies that have not been on physical media in a very long time. And as important as getting them out on physical media is, I certainly can't afford to buy everything that I like. I've got 5,500 movies because I buy them secondhand and in charity shops much of the time. And to build the library that I want, I just can't do it physically. So it's great that this tool is out there and it's helping preserve movies as well, even at the same time as the people who run the actual official streaming services are anti-art bastards who are deleting cinema. So I really value it in that respect.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
I was gonna say, like, I'm really glad that there is like something like Umbrella that is restoring a lot of these films. I mean, there's still so many more I would love to see be brought back out, but I think as well, even though they do mix and match what Umbrella has on their own streaming service of Broly, I think I watched most of the movies through there because they're actually available. So and as a recent announcement coming, I think in June or July, I can't quite remember, but a few films that we talked about on previous episodes are coming out on Blu-ray and people seem very excited, but we didn't have the best things to say about them. But even though I wasn't the biggest fan of the films, I think it's always worth having restored copies and stuff.
A volume one of Ozploitation Rarities. It's a
Yes.
Which include two films we have talked about on the show, which Marcy and I weren't really that big on, which of course were Crosstalk and Lady Stay Dead. But it does have another film which came out in 1980 called Final Cut. So Marcy, I think we might have to do a special bonus episode. So when that movie does come out, we'll have to just review that movie. So
it's weird that it's not on our massive list of Ozploitation movies.
I didn't even know that existed until Umbrella announced it.
Well, we're going to have to add it to the rotation somewhere.
Yeah, we might even do, like, if there's ones where that aren't on the official list that we missed, we might do a bonus episode of, like, the ones we missed through it.
I want the most complete as it can be for this podcast, but I think we're a little bit off topic, so might wrap up the discussion on Midnight Spares.
Yes.
And I give it 3.5 out of 5. I enjoyed it. I had fun. Rest in peace, David Rostoff, for what happened in the film. But, yeah, I quite enjoyed the movie and I'm not going to apologize for that. I think I just wanted something that felt a bit more fun and kind of over the top, and it just kind of delivered exactly what I was after. But yeah, again, I'd say it's worth checking out as well.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating on Midnight Spares?
Yeah, I think I covered it. I think it's a really good stunt show with a sort of middling narrative kind of that doesn't really hold up all of the very good stunts. But if you don't mind a sort of fairly broad screenplay that's just going to deliver these stunt sequences, these car sequences, you could do a lot worse. It's 2.5 for me, but, you know, a mild recommend.
I'm going to give this about a 3 out of 5. It definitely is a mixed bag in terms of its story, but I think the mixture of the performances, the car stunts, and the way it's directed, I do think elevates the film from those flaws, at least for me anyway. So overall, I did enjoy this film, and it's definitely one I will definitely go back to at some point, especially if I want a good piece of Ozploitation fun when it comes to cars. And maybe at some point I'll, just like you, Marcy, I will be a rev head too.
Totally. Gonna be a massive rev head right now.
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on this episode of the Ozploit Cast. And thank you, Marcy, for always being an awesome co-host as per usual.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Sam, for coming back on the show and talking some more Ozploitation with us.
Thanks for having me again. Yeah, hopefully number 5 fairly soon.
We'll definitely organize something again very soon. But in the meantime, though, Marcy, where can people find both you and the podcast on the internet this week?
The Ozploit Cast is available at supermarcy.com. And if you look up the Ozploit Cast on your podcast player, you can subscribe and get all the episodes, and you can always give us a like, a share, and some comments or feedback. We always welcome that. And all your Super Network stuff is available at supermarcy.com as well. And you can follow the Super Network on the many socials. Just check the Super Network link tree. And me personally, I am Super Marcy on all the socials. I am Super_Marcy on Letterboxd. And you can see what weird and wacky things I've been watching. And After Dark with Super Marcy, you can always find that as well on the podcast platforms, and I post about it on the socials as well. And yeah,
awesome. And Sam, where can people find you on the internet this week and also listen to your podcast, The Fearless Pretender?
Yes, you can find me as 24FPS UK on both Blue Sky and Letterboxd. You can find Fearless Pretender on that feed, on my feed at Blue Sky, but we also have a feed for the show itself, which is JJ on Blue Sky. It's also the same on Twitter. My friend and co-host Jason runs the Twitter account and I run the Blue Sky. We've just sort of divided it like that. And you'll find links to the show there. I'm also guest on a bunch of other podcasts. You'll find links to all of those on my Blue Sky as well. And I'm going to fill Marcy and Bede in on this and try and get them on it as they have been on Fearless Pretender. But I'm hopefully towards the end of the year launching a brand new podcast as well. So no details yet, but keep your eyes peeled for that. It's going to be interesting if you're into your movies.
Ooh, I'm very excited for that, Sam. Indeed. And Sorry.
I said indeed.
But if people want to find me personally, you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under B Jermaine as one word. You can also follow all my work over at supermarcy.com. And as well as you can follow my solo show, Bede vs. the Living Dead, and as well as this spinoff, Bede and Steve vs. Camp Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede vs. the Living Dead podcast feed. So, yep, that is a wrap for this episode of the Ozploit Cast. We hope you guys all enjoyed this one. And come back in April for episode 16, in which we will be looking at the films The Return of Captain Invincible, Hostage, BMX Bandits, Innocent Prey, and Melvin, Son of Alvin. So stay tuned for that episode next month, everyone, and we'll see you all then. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Shops are all closed.